On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about how Office Depot might have been trying to help you scan your PC for issues, but what they found could have been a myth. Plus, we have a great guest where Heather Curtis and I talk with Glenn Shoesmith from Booking Bug about helping businesses manage time for their staff and for their customers. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 336, recorded April 5th, 2019. Troubleshooting Clowns. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Thousand Eyes. Companies that run in the cloud rely on Thousand Eyes. It's the place they go first to see, understand, and improve the digital experience of their cloud-based applications and services. Do the cloud right and improve services for your customers and employees today. Visit thousandeyes.com/twit. And by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving it their products a try for free. And by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Find the right people for your business this year at LinkedIn.com/this week and get $50 off your first job post. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely cannot guide you by myself. I need some help from some of the top enterprise tech professionals in the industry and the brains of this outfit, starting with our world traveler, Heather Williams, Senior Product Solutions Architect at Ruckus Networks. Welcome back, Heather. It's great to have you back.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be back.
Now you've been a world traveler over the last couple of weeks. Where have you been going?
I've been in Singapore for Black Hat Asia. It was a great conference, a fantastic keynote. We had a little bit of excitement in the NOC just to keep things keep us on our toes. So if anybody's seen my social media, there's a shout out to the Palo Alto team and the RSA teams that. And the little malware that could.
Fantastic. Definitely check that out. It's a very interesting story. But great to have you back. Of course, we want to add to our expert panel. We have our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, Senior Editor at Dark Reading. Welcome back, Curtis. Great to see you.
It is great to be here, Lou. Always a pleasure to be on Twyatt. I haven't been traveling anything like Mo has. I traveled all the way down to Disney World one day this week for a conference, but that's about it.
Now did I see the materialization of a possible security startup between Padre Chibert and you on social media recently? I think it's included maybe a van and a helipad.
Well, I'm not sure that security is specifically the area. I will say that I suspect that the proper thing to use is. We're currently in stealth mode, and we're working on building out our products, concepts, and pretty much everything else.
Sounds good. It's great to have you back, Curtis. Well, folks, we have a pretty great show today. Now we're going to talk a little bit about retailers and how they might be leading you on when they're cleaning your computer. But we also have a great guest to connect that talks about connecting with customers at a whole different level using technology. But before we do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, startups are known to pivot in the focus of their market segments to have less, to actually go to an area where there's less competition and more ROI. But in this case, in the case of a customer analytics firm Segment, they've decided to go in the other direction. Now, after two false starts, Segment is moving full steam ahead and going up against the Goliaths such as Salesforce and Oracle. Now, you may ask, what can a company do that the giants are actually not doing? Well, they collect customer interactions and produce analytics that give you and your organization insights into customers' behavior. Now, this type of insights take it multiple steps beyond the normal CRM system in today's industry. In just 2017, Segment actually raised $64 million in Series C funding with the Y Combinator Continuity Fund and Google Ventures leading the round. But their focus at that time was just combining data with customer information from just services like Stripe, Salesforce, MailChimp, and Zendesk to generate more detailed customer picture. But what has changed since then? Well, Segment calls out that the CRM sector of the industry only has a small slice of customer experience built in. It's proven by the hunger corporations have to get more data, like Salesforce gobbling up companies like Griddle.io and MuleSoft to bring more data to their platform. What Segment is doing is that they're open sourcing their tools like analytics.js to make it easy to collect customer data from any source and send it to many different tools using a single unified API. Now, the API powers Segment's managed service that helps customers aggregate and visualize the data. Now, with 19,000 customers now, it seems Segment has found the sweet spot in the market. Now it's just a matter of time. The big dogs notice.
Facebook unfriends 400,000 users. And another shout out to the Cisco Umbrella Group, who are also the unsung heroes from Black Hat Asia NOC team this year. The researchers from Talos discovered more than 70 Facebook groups with almost 400,000 users who, instead of using underground forums like most other bad actors, have been using Facebook to sell hacked personal data, offer phishing services, and other illicit behavior. The interesting part about this story is that it wasn't all that difficult for the researchers at Talos to find the 385,000 users. Anyone who does a keyword search for items like spam, carding, or CVV will see multiple search results. And because of the way that Facebook's engagement algorithms match you up with similar groups, once you join one group, Facebook automatically recommends similar groups, which for once makes security researchers' jobs easier. Martin Lee, who's the outreach manager at Cisco Talos, said, "This is a great way to help users discover communities, but there's a flip side. Think of it this way. If you joined a group designed to help you cheat at a video game, it's possible you get served up similar cheating groups that trade in illegal services. And once you're a member of these groups, it's easy to see other members openly selling stolen credit card numbers, identities, and lists of email addresses for use in spam and malware campaigns. And there's some evidence that some of the services are actually users who are actively trying to scam others in the group. After unsuccessfully trying to take down these groups using Facebook's abuse reporting function, Cisco Talos researchers made direct contact with Facebook's research team about the groups, which resulted in the majority of groups being taken down. The takeaway from this is that users need to be proactive in reporting abuse to help take these groups down. And also, there's no honor among thieves.
Well, you expect major financial apps to be secure and functional. Well, the functional part may be true, but we're finding that major mobile financial apps are harboring built-in vulnerabilities. Now, mobile apps for financial services are an important part of the lives of many consumers and companies, yet those apps are suffering a, quote, vulnerability epidemic, end quote, according to a new report. The report, which was commissioned by RSAN and produced by the 8 Group, looks at the perceived security of mobile financial apps versus the reality, and in many cases, to quote a movie title from 1994, reality bites. The report is based on research conducted by 8 Group researcher Alyssa Knight, who decompiled the apps to their original source code for vulnerability assessment. Now, for many of these apps, that first step started the list of vulnerabilities, since application shielding should prevent threat actors from decompiling an application to do their own vulnerability assessment. Retail banking apps had the greatest number of critical vulnerabilities, while the greatest number of severe findings, the next level down, came from auto insurance apps, which contain the most hard-coded private keys, API keys, and secrets in their code. Other common vulnerabilities found in code across all sectors were hard-coded SQL statements and hard-coded private certificates that a threat actor could easily replace and code around. The most secure mobile financial apps? Well, those came from banks that offered health service accounts, or HSAs, followed by health insurance, mobile payment apps, and credit card issuers.
Tisk, tisk. Scan your source code, people. Scan your source code. Well, retailers or retail organizations don't normally develop their own software. Now, when they try, they trip and fall a bunch of times. Now, the technology retailer Best Buy tried this years ago, and it's still trying to find the right recipe, especially in the mobile space. Now, their mobile apps seriously need some help. But what if you were a sporting goods store? Dick's Sporting Goods out of Pennsylvania and their CTO, Paul Gaffney, thinks it's time to bring their software development in-house rather than rely on vendors. Now, having just purchased expensive equipment from Dick's Sporting Goods, I can honestly say there is really low cohesiveness in their apps and background processes. It makes it for an unsuccessful fulfillment process for sure. Now, you may be wondering what the reason why they're going this far down the rabbit hole. Well, it starts with Gaffney, who led similar efforts at Home Depot before he headed over to Dick's Sporting Goods. Now, the focus: to get more return on investment by enhancing business processes, connecting customers better with their products, and making checkout smoother, and also ensuring shipment and fulfillment processes are rock solid. Now, this decision is not without controversy. In fact, analysts believe this will detract attention from being a good retailer. In fact, some analysts are saying unless you have devised the better mousetrap and no commercially available software comes close to supporting your need, buy it. Even with the skeptics out there, the sporting goods store is moving forward full steam ahead. Their success lies on a number of things. Now, for me, I believe they can do it if they're willing to invest and hire the right talent long term in a cost effective manner. Focus on the right part of the software first in stages and support the scale, those pieces slowly. They will be able to say that they pivot successfully. Now, if you have if you're a talented developer or designer out there looking for a job with the sporting goods store, you might be out for some serious opportunities coming soon.
The debate about securing enterprise BYOD and privacy concerns leads to cognitive dissonance. Back in the late 1990s, the technology that allowed workers to forego lengthy commutes and work from home started being rolled out. And ironically, large and ponderous companies who sold this technology, like Nortel, were slow to embrace it and were more often hostile to people trying to work from home. At best, many companies had uneven policies, and individual group and team managers were left to apply it ad hoc. Now, fast forward a decade or two and replace telecommuting with BYOD. Companies have gone back and forth about whether to issue a corporate mobile device, like a phone or a tablet, or to embrace BYOD and allowing those devices access to corporate resources. In an excellent article in Dark Reading by an up-and-coming, young, intrepid reporter, someone named Franklin, there's a discussion about the concerns that companies have about giving these non-corporate devices access to company resources and files. By far the biggest concern with these 671 enterprise IT professionals that were polled was data loss that was due to either the theft or the loss of an employee's mobile device. But almost half of these professionals were also concerned with employee-induced breaches. The article goes on to describe the need for companies to adopt strong, acceptable use policies. And it was beyond the scope of the article to discuss the privacy concerns that are caused by corporate security policies around the BYOD. These days, with more employees being remote and or mobile, and with the processing power and capabilities that these mobile devices have, more workers are relying on their mobile devices for productivity, whether it's emailing, calendar updates, reminders, messaging. The onboarding and securing of these using software like MobileIron, for example, allows companies a way to enforce security policies, but they also allow a company unprecedented access to personal devices. This includes the ability to delete not just company resources, but to wipe the entire device. These are put in specifically in case the device is lost. But this is what's leading to the cognitive dissonance among some employees. Do I give up my security, or do I give up my privacy in exchange for being able to use my personal device for the convenience of accessing company emails, calendar events? And how much do I want Big Brother looking into those devices? I'm going to leave it with that thought. And if you want to hit me up on my social media and give me your ideas, I'd love to hear it.
Oh, I want a piece of that conversation. Well, speaking of privacy and conversation, a new improved BEC campaign is targeting HR and finance. Now, if you don't know the acronym BEC, it's one you should learn. It stands for Business Email Compromise, and certain types of these are known much more widely as phishing or spear phishing. But a new wave of these is targeting direct deposit payroll information. And they are demonstrating that sophisticated technical skills aren't necessary for cybercrime when you can just convince employees to hand you money. Vade Secure recently discovered an ongoing direct deposit spear phishing campaign that used conversational email messages to make first contact with HR representatives in an attempt to enlist their help in redirecting direct deposit funds into the criminals' accounts. With BEC scams, attackers often use common public email services like AOL, Gmail, or Hotmail as the source of their spear phishing messages. But in February, a group named London Blue switched to spoofing the company email address of the CEO in order to add urgency and authenticity to their attack messages. Now, all of this is essentially a form of social engineering. Colin Bastable, CEO of Lucy Security, said, "Criminals are often using people's fear of authority or responsiveness to authority, but you're also targeting people who want to get things done, you know, and they're empowered. So it is really about behavior," end quote. Now, cybersecurity experts say that robust financial control systems can play a huge role in protecting against campaigns like these, as can technology that identifies and protects against spoofed email addresses and highly suspect email contents.
Now, many of you out there have tried out the genealogy DNA mapping services to gain more insights into your history. Now, it can be fun if you like that sort of thing. Now, however, there has always been a concern about the privacy and security of your data once these companies have it. Can they sell it? Can they share it? Can someone just take it? Well, a couple of months ago, privacy concerns were raised when Family Tree DNA revealed that the company had partnered with the FBI and given the agencies access to genealogy database. Well, law enforcement's use of DNA databases has been widely known since last April when California officials revealed genealogy website information was instrumental in determining the identity of the Golden State Killer. Now, several weeks later, Family Tree DNA changed their rules to allow customers to block the FBI from accessing their information. But now the company seems to be embracing this partnership with law enforcement again with their new paint campaign called Families Want Answers. Now, Family Tree DNA wants to appeal to a large range of people. The president founder, Bennett Greenspan, seemed to appeal to both genealogy hobbyists and true crime fans. He says, "The genealogy community has the ability to crowdsource crime-solving information, and if Family Tree DNA can help prevent violent crimes, save lives, or bring closure to families, then we feel the company has a moral responsibility to do so." Now you just have to ignore the movies Gattaca and Minority Report and do the morally responsible thing and give Family Tree DNA your genetic makeup. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to those, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Thousand Eyes. Now, have you ever watched those sci-fi flicks where they have these war rooms with the, you know, in the network knock rooms where they have all these screens on the board where you can like look at what's going on any point of your network in reality? Well, in reality, imagine that was possible even with a Thousand Eyes. You already know that the internet is the backbone of organizations and enterprises. It's a complex network of nodes and data. And when your business depends on it, you need to have deep insights into the health and performance of it. Well, Thousand Eyes is going to make this easier for you and your organization. Nowadays, with tons of cloud apps, PaaS and SaaS services like Office 365, WebEx, Salesforce, and more, you have to have a view or lay of the land of the network. Now, you know, you could go and see what's affecting customers in one way, but this is really going to give you insights. It's in the company's name. They give you more than 1,000 eyes to surface the data you need to provide best-in-class service to you and your customers. Now, they have a concept of network agents. You deploy these agents throughout your network, and you're instantly able to visualize and monitor and diagnose your networks. Whether you deploy them on virtual appliances or Hyper-Vs or others, they really make it easy to start getting valuable information about the network that's affecting your business. So these agents are sensors, and they're deployed globally and then give you pulse data from wherever it's in the network. Now imagine you have users and customers that are complaining they can't access a network service or even an application like Office 365 because it's too slow in Japan. Well, your cloud agent in Japan can give you data you need to diagnose where in the network is causing the issue. Now, global sets of customers are not a problem for Thousand Eyes. They give you that vantage point you need to solve and diagnose and solve. Now, they also have a concept of enterprise agents as well, where you can actually install them, whether it's a branch office or a data center, and they give you kind of a hybrid view of the end-to-end look of your entire network. They also have the power of your to give you views of your end users as well. They have endpoint agents as well to kind of give you that customer view and what they're actually seeing with your network. Now, all the data is collected and aggregated where it's actually processed, correlated for patterns and across all the agents. It truly creates a network intelligence view. Now, it helps you kind of visualize the connectivity across your entire network. Now, they actually put themselves into the brains and eyes of network engineers and IT professionals because you can envision the network looking a certain way. And this way is not really just using bar graphs, charts, line graphs. You need to visualize spatially. And that's where Thousand Eyes provides a really beautiful real set of visualizations that really encapsulate the complexity of your network and make it easy for you to see the data you need to proactively and reactively support your network. Not only do they do that, but they also have a unique path visualization technology that extends beyond the boundaries, allowing you to kind of see and understand and improve the experience for all of your apps, services, and websites. Now, no more Wireshark to try and figure out your issues. Your networks are more than just MPLS backbone networks. You need more than package captures and NetFlows. Thousand Eyes helps you solve real-world issues with unique, actionable data and great visualizations. Regain control of your network and ensure the best possible experience for your customers, employees. Get an immediate, unmatched view of all your networks and dependencies that impact your users' digital experience. Visit thousandeyes.com/twit to see what you've been missing. You'll get the exclusive ebook on the 5 cloud migration challenges you shouldn't ignore. If the cloud is important to you, either today or in your future, visit thousandeyes.com/twit. That's thousandeyes.com/twit. Thousand Eyes thrive in a connected world. And we thank Thousand Eyes for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's that time of the show. We get to jump in some bites for this week. And, you know, you actually probably purchased a PC at a retailer in the past, and you've heard that line about purchasing service plans as a peace of mind to ensure that you kind of keep things up to date for and running for years, whether it's virus protection, firewall protection, malware, and ransomware protection. They kind of throw them at you, and sometimes, you know, they use scare tactics to make you buy them. Now, fast forward some time, and you or a relative or your friend might have a problem with your PC, and you bring it to a retailer to diagnose it, and why is it running so slow, or if you had a virus. And did you leave there without getting a scan? Probably not. You probably went there, and you got a scan or diagnostic. You paid a diagnostics fee. But what if I told you that if you went to Office Depot between 2009 and 2016, you might have gotten baited by support.com's false positive PC health check? Now, get this. Not just used computers, but the Office Depot stores claimed to find infections on brand new computers that had never been connected to the internet. Now, the stores offered PC health check scans for free, while claiming the value of the scans was between $20 and $60. But PC Health Check was configured to tell customers and consumers their computers were infected regardless of what scan showed, according to the FTC. Now, at the beginning of each scan, the consumers were asked if they experienced PC problems. And if they answered yes in the survey, then they guaranteed that the program would flag a problem with the user's computer. According to the FTC, PC Health Check tricked these consumers into thinking their computers had symptoms of malware or other actual infections, even though the scan hadn't found any issues. Now, consumers were told that the software could optimize and correct the problem, but according to the FTC, it did little to nothing for the consumer or the user to fix the problem. Now, after displaying fake scan results, the consumer had to check any of the 4 boxes PC Health Check displayed. Also displayed a view recommendation button with a detailed description of the tech services, and consumers were encouraged to purchase services on top of what they've already done, possibly even costing hundreds of dollars later. Now, in some cases, store employees checked the box themselves, guaranteeing that the software would produce a warning. Now, the FTC complaint says defendants trained Office Depot and Office Max store employees on how to utilize the PC Health Check program and instruct the software store employees to check any of the initial checkbox statements that applied based on consumer responses. Okay, so I want to throw this over to you guys because, you know, I've worked in the past at a lot of these big box stores. In fact, I worked at Best Buy back in the high school days, and I was working in the tech department, the geek kind of the geek squad today. And I can tell you that sometimes when you diagnose something, diagnostics is sometimes fickle because you kind of have to, it's whatever point of view you might have, like, hey, machine's slow. Maybe it's your registry. Maybe it's this. Maybe it's that. And so by running these scans or these cleanup tools, sometimes it's kind of done on demand because you don't really know exactly what's going on. I want to throw it to you guys. I want to start with you, Heather. Is it like, is this really fraud? Like, I think what they're saying is this is fraud, but is it really fraud or is it just a way of them saying, hey, like you could have a problem and then they make it, then you as a consumer make a choice on whether you want to fix it or not?
Okay, so I have a couple of points here. First, let's be clear, this was the FTC that was fining them. If this was the FCC and we drew a parallel with robo-dialing, not only would this not be fraud, but they would be making it government policy that they were allowed to do this and should be doing this. But since this is the FTC and they're claiming that it's fraud, you've got a good point about the difficulties behind diagnostics and some of the fickleness there. I'm a Wi-Fi engineer. We don't answer any question that doesn't start with, well, it depends.
Okay. Right.
So I can certainly sympathize. But the bottom line is it didn't matter what the scan results were, the entire answer was going to be based on one of four questions and if he answered yes to any one of them. So it's not that it's fickle or it's difficult to diagnose and, you know, maybe it's malware, maybe it's just a Chrome extension. It's fraud. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, and buts. And I think that a more apt parallel to what these guys were doing is the guy who knocks on your door after a rainstorm to replace your roof. Do you have a roof? Yes. Therefore, you need a new roof. sort of thing. And I think that it's giving IT people who work in this kind of field. And, you know, let's face it, they're not the most educated. This is where a lot of us got our start. Is in something like this, but to start off with a reputation that's equivalent to the shyster car mechanic is, I think, doing a disservice to our industry.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one big problem. I do want to throw this to you, Curtis, because I think Heather brings up a good point. I think, you know, there's always I've always had problems where I'm not versed in some areas. Obviously, I'm not a plumber, and I don't like to fix things at home sometimes. And so when they come in, you know, have to kind of trust them in some cases. You know, that's why you get multiple different quotes from different people. In this case, though, it's a scary thing for people. I mean, you know, there's people who are not really versed in technology or computers. Their computer's not working. They don't have people or relatives or friends to help them out. So they bring it in and they get some help from the store they bought it from. Is this really fraud, or is it just like Heather was saying, or is this just a way for the retailers to make a little extra cash and hopes that they can move their business forward in that part of the space?
Well, see, that you used a phrase that was really interesting because you said, is this just a way for the retailer to earn a little extra cash? Well, if they're earning a little extra cash by doing something that isn't called for, that's fraud. Now, if they say we're going to scan and charge you $5 for the scan and then let you know what it says, that's the same thing as, you know, when you take your car in to have the oil changed and they do the 21-point inspection where they go around and look and see if there's anything else they can charge you money for.
Right.
You know, that inspection, the scan itself, isn't necessarily fraud. And it really does depend on why it's being done and what's being done with the results. You know, if this is part of the normal diagnostic process for the organization and they accept the results and, you know, might or might not recommend anything, well, then that's fine. But if they run this and it's, you know, the equivalent, as Heather said, of the auto mechanic who keeps the pot of sludgy old oil ready to pour on the dipstick to show the customer just how bad conditions are inside their relatively smoothly running engine, then you got a problem. And I think that what we had here was probably widespread, massive lack of training and incompetence that crossed the line into fraud, because it was really easy to do so, and no managers were complaining about extra revenue.
Right. So I think, Curtis, you bring up a good point. I think I want to throw this to Heather as a question too, because I think, you know, a lot of these retailers, they're big, they're kind of run by their GMs and sales managers of that, and they kind of own their revenue for that store, and they have to answer to why things are not doing well. I remember the days of having to sell service plans and not hitting the quota and so on and so forth. Heather, obviously Office Depot is being blamed as a corporation because they are the name of these stores and they kind of run them. But is this kind of basically to blame the associates, the model that they have is to say, hey, you haven't hit your quota, so do something to actually get that quota. And they took it upon themselves to get this higher revenue just by leading on customers and using kind of that questionable space?
Well, with the numbers that you're talking about, the amount of money that they were pulling in off of this wasn't a regional thing where a few associates came up with an idea of how to solve their problem of getting in trouble because they didn't make quota. These kinds of numbers speak to a systemic problem. Now, even if it weren't systemic, the buck stops upward. Right. I mean, if you as a manager or a manager's manager or as an executive leader have either encouraged either through culture or through unrealistic expectations in terms of quota, or you have allowed it to proliferate because you don't know what the heck's going on in your individual stores. At any rate, it's got to be, the buck has to stop somewhere, and blaming the 19-year-old who's doing this as a part-time job and has just figured out what C-colon means is probably a dumb idea. But let me just draw a parallel to this and not the roofers or the plumbers, but where's another place where we've seen consumers being told that they have, and by the way, anything that has to do with computers, what percentage of the population isn't going to listen to the next words that come out of the so-called professional's mouth? Because, you know, everybody knows how to charge their phone, but nobody could explain how, LTE works. And the same thing for most networks or, you know, even just a computer. The one place that I can see, and this has happened to almost all of my older relatives, is the phone call that you get that says, you know, hey, I'm from Microsoft support and you have a problem on your computer we have detected and we're here to help you. Now, in that case, it's a pretty, that's a very clear cut case of a scam, spam event going on. How is it different than, because I happened to walk into Office Depot and said, could you just check? How is there a difference in that kind of a scam? Except for that, in this case, the fly came to the spider's web instead of the spider web hunting down the fly.
Right. I think you bring up a good point. I think I've had family members actually run into this issue. It's a social engineering technique, and you know they will continue to use this. Salespeople will continue to use it. It just hopes that they won't go as far as they're going, obviously, because it is fraud. Well, folks, let's go ahead. I want to throw this over to Kurt too, because he has a really interesting bite as well about security learnings from leadership.
Yeah, we were just talking about whether some behavior was the fault of sort of line employees or leadership. And there's another well-known instance that's been in the news and even in movies that asks some of those same questions. We had an article this week about lessons security leaders can learn from Theranos. Now, remember Theranos? They were that great company that was going to be able to very quickly run an entire panel of disease-seeking tests on a single drop of blood. And in a new HBO documentary called The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley, all of us get to see the very cautionary tale of Elizabeth Holmes, the young entrepreneur who dropped out of Stanford at the age of 19 to start Theranos. The company was going to disrupt this $36 billion industry, and it turned out to be massive fraud. So how did this happen? How did so many very smart people help this happen? Well, the writer of the article says that there are three big lessons that people who are executives, and especially those in IT and security, can learn. First, know your silos. You know, we hear a lot about breaking down silos and getting teams to work together, but know where your silos are. In the case of Theranos, the engineering teams that were supposed to be building this magical thing were physically and literally as separate as possible from the rest of the company. So make sure that your silos, if they must exist, are there for a very concrete and, I would add, legal reason. And if you don't want the silos in place, put some incentives in place to get people on different teams to talk to one another. Now, next is beware of false positives. So in the case of Theranos, they were telling consumers that they could just go ahead and prescribe their own tests and find out about all kinds of things that could be happening in their blood. That's probably not the best of ideas because so many of those results need to be interpreted by someone who has a clue that didn't come from a Google search, of what those results mean. So beware of systems, processes, and technology that give you false positives. And finally, allow for dissent. Always beware of being in or creating a culture where the only responsible and allowable contribution to a discussion is to agree with what the boss is saying. Now, ultimately, someone has to make a decision, and the entire team needs to be around, get around that. But there should always be good discussion. Pardon me for a second. And very vibrant discussion about the pros and cons of whatever course of action is being considered. The pros and cons of whatever is being built and whether it's succeeding. So create that culture so that you know you will hear honestly whether someone agrees with you or not. And those employees know that they'll be able to dissent without it having a huge impact on their career potential. Lou, I want to bring you into this because you manage people. You have a culture for your team and you work within a larger culture. So what do you think? Was the culture there at Theranos sort of uniquely toxic, or are there a lot of companies that could find themselves in this same boat because of the culture?
That's a great question, because there are a lot of companies that are in this boat. I mean, think about it. Apple, back in the years of Steve Jobs, you know, the whole concept of silos was there. Even in today's business, they still have had problems getting into the services business because of that. Even Microsoft had the silo problem, which is, now that, new CEOs come in, he's changed the culture. It's definitely altered that. I think we're better business because of it. Another thing, kind of knowing your silos is important, because you got to know where you need to actually improve on and know where you actually have to make more cohesion within your business. It's really important. I think false positive ones are really interesting too, because a lot of businesses out there today are trying to be more agile. And so in order to be agile, you have to be reactive. And sometimes you react on things that might be a false positive, like a one kind of incident or isolated scenario. And so that it becomes a hard thing to root through. And I think that's where more data will help. The biggest thing, the last thing you talked about culture, making sure that everyone's voice is heard. We've been trained, we train our employees, even at Microsoft, about what we call crucial conversations. And these are things of making sure everyone's voice is heard, because everyone has an interesting and very valuable point of view, no matter if it's not yours or it's one that you agree on or not. And it really does help businesses break down barriers. And I think it's interesting because it sounds kind of like fluffy in a sense, but the truth of the matter is it does really help, and it makes you shift your business in the right direction. I think all of these are super valuable, and they're definitely not particular to this business.
You know, I agree with you, and I think it's fascinating to watch those cultures in action. Heather, I want to turn to you, because you and I share something in that we both work day to day in an environment where our office doesn't put us in a cubicle next to a lot of our coworkers. And what have you seen about the way this culture can be built to involve people who aren't, you know, sitting around the corporate lunch table with fellow employees on a day-to-day basis?
Well, now that's an interesting take, because I was actually looking at this. And by the way, this is a great bite. I love this entire topic. I was actually looking at it a little bit differently. But in terms of, yeah, when you become a telecommuter, or when all of your closest colleagues are not even in the same time zone, and sometimes not even on the same continent, there can be challenges to creating like the esprit de corps. But, you know, just being able to reach out the hallway conversations where so much insight is gleaned, that takes more effort. I'm going to take a step back, though, and question whether siloing was really part of the problem in this case, because it's not that nobody was questioning it. It's that it was outside people were questioning it. In fact, doctors were saying, like, medically, this is impossible what you're trying to do. It's just that she did a great job of covering up their input and not passing it along. So I think that definitely this is a case of the fish rots from the head. And I think that one of the things that brings this more to the front, because we're all used to, I mean, there have been an unfortunate number of Ponzi schemes over the last two decades that we could probably just, you know, Enron, everybody else, that this could be just a one more story. I think that one of the reasons this hits so hard is that this isn't just another technology story that we're talking about. It's hard to get your head wrapped around. This is medical. This is people's biology. This is really important. And I think one of the comments that you made earlier about getting someone who knows what they're talking about to interpret is really important, because a lot of people don't understand, but medical results, I can give you a number associated with a parameter like a CBC, but it could mean different things depending on the type of lab, where the lab is, how they ran that test, and having a trained medical person to actually be able to tell you, well, this number was 10, but another lab, 10 would be normal, but with this lab, they skew a little bit differently because of the way they treat some of those parameters. I think all of that's really important. And by the way, I just so y'all know, I used to teach AP biology, so this is something that I know it's hard to believe, but it's one of those things that it hits home. I can't go to WebMD without coming back with a diagnosis of toe cancer. I don't care what my symptoms were. So if you're handing out just an over-the-counter, fairly difficult type of blood test, and then you want somebody to take that away and have something meaningful, whether it was run legitimately or not, and in this case they weren't being run legitimately, I think it's incredibly difficult to be able to interpret these things so that they're meaningful. I used to tell my students, if you do a problem and you don't include the units after the end of it, you haven't done science, you've done math. And in this case, these tests were, you know, math that were calculated incorrectly, but they were still just math because there was no meaning behind any of the units that were being provided.
You know, that's a great point. There are all kinds of lessons we can draw from this. And to me, one of them, is that it's critical for both individual employees and the culture of the organization not to allow anyone to be intimidated by the founder. I have worked with a lot of really bright people. I have interviewed a lot of really bright people. And you can't let the fact that you're dealing with a really bright person keep you from saying, you know, in this instance, I don't see how you're right. Walk me through this using small words and short sentences. Convince me that you're right. And if you can't say that, then there's a bad culture going on. If you're at the top, if you see that going on, don't let it stroke your ego. Let it stroke your paranoia, because it means that your organization is setting itself up for some really huge problems down the line. Well, that does it for this bite. So it's time for me to hand it back to our fearless leader, Lou. Over to you.
Thanks, Curtis. Great bite. Great bite. Well, folks, that does it for the bites. Next up, we bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the TWiET, right? Before we do, we have another great sponsor we have to thank, and that is Atlassian. Now, whether you are an engineer or IT team or one who just wants to manage a large team and their working items, you probably have used an Atlassian product or two. Now, I remember back in 2002 when Atlassian was launching their perfectly timed product that met the needs of that emerging agile market. Originally, it was conceived as a bug tracking tool, but the Jira ticket became the digital record of choice for tracking units of work in a highly collaborative and agile environment. Now, fast forward 16 years and DevOps is on everyone's docket, and Atlassian is still leading the pack in areas that helps teams rise to the occasion. Now, for me, I've been using Bitbucket for years to manage some of my projects, source code, and documentation, plus tickets for those projects come through Jira, and I'm alerted on my Microsoft Teams channels as well. Now, Atlassian really is a collaboration software company that empowers IT teams around the world. Now, like all organizations, you want to ship faster, more efficiently, and with higher quality. Plus, you want to ensure your customers' feedback adds to the business value prop. Now, sometimes businesses fall short because of all their disjointed workflows. Well, this is where Atlassian's wheelhouse is. They give you and your organization the power to manage complex collaboration. Now, Atlassian provides a technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support the kind of change that propels a business forward. Now, plus their tools and services are not just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all sizes. Now, from DevOps to Agile, IT apps to Ops, ITSM, and to whatever's next, Atlassian provides the technology backbone to help your organization. Now, with Jira Software, Confluence, and Bitbucket, Atlassian forms the backbone of effective cross-team project planning, organization, and communication. With Jira Ops, Opsgenie, and Status Page, they help teams to better detect incidents, alert rich response teams, and coordinate response efforts to resolve issues faster and keep customers and stakeholders up to date. Now, your teams can choose tools that are right for your current workflow and framework while trusting as you grow, because they will grow with you. Like all Atlassian products, the tools for your IT team are easy and free to try. Just head over to Atlassian.com/IT to find out which Atlassian offering is right for your team. Try Atlassian today to see what IT can be. That's Atlassian.com/IT. And we thank Atlassian for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the TWiET riot. And today we have Glenn Shoesmith, founder and CEO of Booking Bug. Welcome, Glenn, to the show.
Hey there, great to be here.
So thank you for being here. Our audience loves origin stories. Can you maybe take the folks at home through your journey of the industry and how you ended up at Booking Bug?
Absolutely. So as a founder, actually, it's really interesting to be a technology founder. You see so many founders that are sort of MBA and business developer founders, but I'm actually a classic computer programmer, you know, degree in computer science. I spent about 10 years working for different technologies companies. I worked in TV for a bit. I worked in sort of enterprise consulting. I worked for a number of investment banks, and some of them were good. Some of them were pretty horrific. Some of them don't exist anymore. And I decided that, you know, I was done writing code for other people, and I've always had that entrepreneurial bent. I've always spent my weekends writing code as a good geek. And I've always been sort of working on different ideas. And eventually I just came up with the idea of Booking Bug for the simple frustration of I was trying to book a squash court. So I was trying to book a squash court near me where I was working in East London. And I realized that the local squash court, they were like, well, we don't have an online booking system. We can't take online payments. And we can't take payments over the phone. So you're going to have to come here in person to book this squash court in order to pay for it, in order to go away, in order to come back to play squash. I'm like, this is the stupidest customer experience I've ever heard of. I'm trying to go and do some exercise. I'm a completely unfit geek. I'm trying to do some exercise and you're making it really hard for me. And in London, we were trying to win this thing called the Olympics. And everyone was like, government should get more people doing sport. And I was like, Jeff Bezos would never make it hard for you to buy something. His entire mantra with Amazon, even back then, was like, if you want to buy something at 3 a.m. in your underwear, I'm going to sell it to you and ship it to you before you've had a chance to regret it. And I realized for so many service businesses, whether it was I want to take up a Pilates class, I want to take up a dance class, I want to do a photography course, whatever it was, service businesses were really badly served online. E-commerce was a really solved problem. You could buy anything of a goods-based economy. And hotels and restaurants were there. But actually, that long tail of dance classes, squash courts, tennis lessons, wedding photographers, you know, wedding photography websites had great pictures that they took of weddings, but they didn't tell you whether he was free on your wedding day, which is surely the most important question. So this idea of showing service businesses availability on the internet and allowing you to book them, allowing you to pay for them, allowing them to basically sell their goods in an e-commerce style structure online, I thought was going to be a huge sort of growth market. And that was now 11 years ago.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good set of the sector of the market because there's a gap there. I think very certain, like especially field service workers, customer service workers who need to sign up and have, you know, like you go to the Apple store, you have to sign up for, you have to get in line, so to speak. There's always a way to improve that experience. Now, I know you talked a little bit about fintech, financial banks. Now, where is this kind of getting into the market more? Is it more on the financial side? Is it more on the kind of like services side, or is it kind of getting into all of those sides?
Well, I talked about fintech. I mean, I used to work for investment banks on trading floors, so that was a very, very different market. But for Booking Bug, we transitioned from the classics like SME kind of approach of business. We were going after the rabbits, you know, that enterprise to SME model. We started with all the SMEs. There's millions of rabbits you can go after. And then suddenly we started to get these enterprises come and going, hang on, we need a booking system. And for a long time, actually, it was very much the sort of retailers, the high street retailers. And they all had this problem of we want to engage, you know, customers more. We need to get customers more into store. We need to compete with Jeff Bezos better. But actually, banks and government have now started to pick up on that as well. You know, for every retailer that's being digitally disrupted by an online player, now the banks are starting to be disrupted as well by the digital-only banks that go, hang on, we can run our business a lot more efficiently than you. We don't need branches. We don't need stores. So our costs are lower. We don't have all this staff headcount. And then suddenly the banks have got to up their game as well. They've got to up their customer experience and they've got to engage customers better. And that's what we've ended up growing into from starting as an SME platform to really growing into helping in England, I'd say high street. In the US, we say main street. I always have to adjust my my frame of reference, but it's the same problems, both sides of the Atlantic.
Makes sense. So now, like, maybe you could take us kind of through the customer journey here. So like, you're handling appointments, you're handling events, like how does the customer, like an organization implement this and how does the customer experience it?
It's actually one of the key things to get right, actually. And it's actually one of the things that businesses often get wrong. So they'll go like, right, we've heard our customers, they want to be able to book online. So we'll put an online booking system on. It's in the footer of the website. You have to search for it in the search thing and you go to the somewhere or other and then the third link down and then click on the right and you'll find it. And then unsurprisingly, no one books. The most successful companies have done this well, have put it in their email campaigns, they've put it on their homepage, they've put it on their Twitter, they've put it on their Facebook. They're like, you know, put a Facebook thing up saying, book now, come in for an appointment, come in and try out some new golf clubs, come in and book a hair appointment, come in and try out a suit fitting, come in and obviously social media companies know a terrifying amount about you, right? They know if you're expecting a kid, they know if your kid's birthday, you can say, come in and plan a birthday party. You can say, you know, one of our most popular categories is expectant parents who are going to spend a lot of money and don't know what they need to buy yet. And they're the perfect people to come into stores and have a nice consultative experience where they'll walk out several thousand dollars poorer, but a lot happier with the company and the brand they went to rather than just trying to shop online. So the customer experience actually starts with actually trying to find that right opportunity, that right market where suddenly someone goes, I don't just want to buy this. I want to speak to someone. I want to talk to another human. And even millennials, people still like talking to humans.
Right. So you bring up an interesting perspective. I think a lot of companies, like, for instance, I know the different sectors of the market, like, for instance, doctor's offices have this issue. I know that, you know, field service or even plumbers and other things have this issues. Well, what kind of, are you focusing more on the larger businesses, like the larger service businesses, or does it also work for kind of the small business as well?
So we started with small businesses, right? And actually, we've sort of turned off our small business offering at the moment, and we might turn it back on in a year or two once we've upgraded some of our platforms. But we very much started with small businesses. Yes, we were after movable vans and you know, hairdressers. I've stood at hairdressing shows, the most surreal couple of days standing talking to hairdressers for 3 days. But children's entertainers, trying to debug support issues for a clown. It's very, very surreal. But actually, we found a lot more traction, a lot more weight, and a lot more value in really the enterprise space, right? They have bigger budgets. Obviously, you know, this is an enterprise show. You all understand the benefits of selling to the enterprise against the SMEs. The weird thing is the SME that pays you a dollar sometimes expects more higher quality service than the enterprise client that pays you $1,000 because they understand the complexity of what it is you're doing.
When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the some of the integration solutions that they have. Obviously, a lot of people use CRM systems, and to be able to be organizational and be able to stay on top of things, they need this type of data to be integrated into it. But before we do, I do want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Now, where are all the professionals today? You know, they're on LinkedIn. If you're actually hiring for a small business or a large enterprise, naturally you want to find the best person for the job. And any odds, they are actually a person on LinkedIn. Now, it's the world's largest professional network. 70% of the U.S. workforce is on LinkedIn. That's a pretty high number. Now, some of the biggest names in the industry post content on there every day. I post out there jobs, interests, technology, everything. My professional network wouldn't be what it is today without LinkedIn. Now, that just goes to show you that LinkedIn can really help your business. Now, post your job where people can go every day to make connections, grow in their career, and discover job opportunities. Now, you've used other sites, but they just really just don't feel right. They're clunky, plus your responses to your jobs are really not from the right people. Now, what I've seen from my job postings on LinkedIn is that LinkedIn jobs are matched based on skills and background, but they add that secret sauce recipe by also matching based off of interests, activities, passions, and more. Impressive, most impressive. Now, what does that mean for your business? Well, it means that the LinkedIn will match you quickly with a group of most relevant, qualified candidates for that job you're looking to fill. Now, and that way you can focus on the candidates you want to spend time talking to and make quality hires you're excited about. Now, if you think about it, there are 500 million pros on LinkedIn every day. LinkedIn is the best way to get your job opportunity in front of the right people. Why else would customers rank LinkedIn jobs number one in delivering high quality hires? Now, if it works for you, it will also give you that target of that next generation workforce with really laser precision. I bet you wouldn't be surprised if I told you new hires made every 8 seconds using LinkedIn. I've used them in the past, and it's amazingly fast and scales your talent acquisition just by using LinkedIn. Post a job today at linkedin.com/this week and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/this week to get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/this week. Terms and conditions apply. And we thank LinkedIn for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. So we're talking with Glenn Shoesmith, founder and CEO of BookingBug. Glenn, I find this very interesting because this is definitely a sector of the market and part of businesses that do find large issues with, you know, kind of connecting with their customer, you know, being able to book time with them and connect with them But another question I get a lot of from businesses is how does it integrate? Because I already have service, application services out there like Salesforce or CRM that I'm already integrating with, and they already have, you know, customer service and field service mechanisms in there. Does this integrate with them as well?
Absolutely. I mean, for us, I always consider what we do as such an center's web of integrations. And for me, our integrations engine and our integrations platform is actually been a huge investment in what we've done. It's slightly annoying that we're actually not always capable of using sort of third-party integration tool sets, because often you're, you know, we work with investment banks, for example, to do, you know, appointment booking systems for some of the biggest banks in the world. We work with a lot of governments. So the need for security is paramount. So, you know, you're talking, you know, you're talking on the front page to the customer. So you're then, you know, integrated all the Google Analytics side. Then the customer data might be linked to their CRM. So you've got Salesforce or Oracle or Microsoft. And then obviously your customer data then might get synced off to the marketing tools to show that they've, you know, interacted with you in some way. If there was a payment involved, that goes off to your payments engine. If there was an invoice from that payment, that goes off to your invoicing tool. Obviously, the staff time itself might go to your staff management, your staff data workflow tools. So there's so many integration points, and they all have to work. And it's actually one of the problems we face. You know, when we're dealing with an enterprise client that maybe has 20,000 staff, everyone's like, well, you know, it's a calendar, right? But when you were integrating to all these different systems and platforms and security and single sign-on, and then you're syncing to 20,000 Exchange calendars, and you've got to show to a customer, can they have a mortgage appointment at 9 p.m. on Tuesday in 2 seconds? You know, this becomes a really big data enterprise platform, of which, yeah, all of that, you've got to know every staff member's calendars, their holidays, if they're off sick, when the branch is shut, everything. So yeah, integrations are key. It's one of the biggest workflow systems we worked on in the last year was actually about building a really extensible integration tool set. And for me, as a sort of real platform geek, I looked at a lot of what Salesforce does and how Salesforce allows you to write triggers and workflows and stuff. And I really leveraged off that to try and build an entire tool set that makes, you know, integration endpoints work very reliably. Because again, you miss a booking, you know, you miss a booking communicated to a third party system and someone turns up and they weren't expected, that's a really bad customer experience there. And it's so easy, you know, that communication didn't go, that reminder didn't go. Suddenly you've got a really, you've got an unhappy customer somewhere, and that's not, you know, that's not acceptable. So integrations are key. Integrations are everything.
And now you recently announced a new workforce experience. You're calling it Studio. Can you maybe tell us about that and what led to that?
Absolutely. So obviously for years with BookingBug, we were very focused on the customer experience. You know, we're very much a sort of customer journey platform. We're all about bringing this crossing this digital divide, bringing the customer back into the branch. But of course, for many enterprise platforms, the staff experiences aren't desperately great. And when I talk about Studio, I often use the comparison of Salesforce, right? You know, anyone that's used Salesforce, I'm sure you'll have, you know, the classic experience of Salesforce was starting to look very dated. It was enormously powerful, but it was starting to look dated. It didn't work very well on the mobile. It didn't work very well on the tablet. So they introduced Lightning. And basically, actually, almost in parallel, we had the similar kind of flow to introduce our modern staff tool set. Which we've called Studio. So, and again, I've taken a lot of leaves on how to build a sort of really flexible, dynamic tool set. So it's not a fixed SaaS product. It is an entirely flexible staff tool set that you can customize all kinds of different aspects of it. You can customize how the flows, you can inject other tools into it. So it can be used as a framework. It can be used both ways. It can be used as a framework, which other tools can be injected into, or it itself can be injected into other tools like Salesforce. So it's designed to be this very powerful, flexible tool set. In the same way, as you said, data integrations are key, tool set integrations are key. Staff don't want to be flipping between tool A to tool B to tool C. I don't want to have to look at my customer record over here, my calendar over there, the e-commerce history over there. I want all my tools to flow together. Otherwise, that time that the staff is standing around looking stupid on the sales floor, trying to work out which device they're using or which technology they're using, or if they're signed onto the right thing, is disastrous for the business. So we spend a long time trying to build a really, really flexible, powerful, tablet-driven tool set that worked well with other enterprise tools, but could allow other enterprise tools to work well with us.
Fantastic. Now, I do want to bring my co-host back in. They have some pretty interesting questions to ask. Heather, over to you for a data question.
Yeah, I think you've made the point about how important integration is quite well. You mentioned security a couple of times, and you may or may not have picked up on how concerned I am with privacy these days. So I was just curious, since you're obviously based in England, you probably have run into this. How has GDPR affected your day-to-day or some of the processes that you guys are doing?
That's an excellent question. So, I mean, GDPR has been, you know, a huge impact for us, not just with our UK business, but everyone else around the world, actually, that works through Europe, has had to start thinking about GDPR if they're not already interacting with European clients. Their own countries are actually looking at that kind of thing. You know, we work a lot in Australia and New Zealand as well, and they're looking at similar policies there. So for us, it's been brilliant, right? You know, we've been a PCI compliant payment provider for years. We're ISO 27001, ISO 27017 and 18. You know, we supply systems to central government. These people take data obfuscation, data security very, very seriously. So for us, it was brilliant because it put smaller companies that were competitors of ours sort of on notice that they couldn't sort of be fly by night about this kind of, you couldn't, some people very much play a, well, let's have lax security and hope that nothing bad happens. And of course, anything could happen to any of us. There's no such thing as perfect security. I wish there was, but you know, the input of GDPR, putting the customer, putting the user back in control, has been really interesting for us. And obviously, there's a very white label platform that sits behind the scenes. It's often not us that has to work with the sort of individual users to actually manage their GDPR data, but we have to give the tools to the businesses we work with for them to be able to respond to GDPR requests that come in. But yeah, it did require some re-engineering, particularly when it came to sort of back clearing and obfuscating, you know, archived copies and historical records of data, and making sure that we took all the appropriate actions for, say, data obfuscation and data security. We had a lot of them in place already for a lot of the government work we do, but it's had us to continue to step up. And that's great. You know, every time we add more layers to that, it makes me sleep better at night.
Well, since I'm coming off of jet lag from Singapore, anything that makes anyone sleep better at night, I am fully supportive of. So I have another question. This isn't exactly a follow-up. In fact, it's borderline silly. But just to sort of like maybe give some people a better idea of the role that you guys are playing. And by the way, I live 90 minutes from the nearest Asian market. I live in the middle of nowhere in a very rural area. So your analogy with Amazon can ship you anything before you have time to regret it is very well taken. So I'm going to take it just a little bit further and again, be a little bit silly. You may or may not notice that I sort of have a manicure fetish, and it has been 3 weeks, but I live in the middle of nowhere. Finding a good nail salon is not a trivial problem that I have. How could a platform such as yours help me interact with when I'm looking for a new service? Anybody who's had to relocate, the first thing you have to do is go through all of the services that you take for granted and find your new one. How is it that this could help me as an end user have a better interaction and find just that perfect spa day?
So this is actually a market we started in, and it's actually very much we've moved away from. In the early days, like, you know, sort of 2007, 2008, there were lots of companies like BookingBug trying to both be the destination site and the booking engine. And it was like, come to us for all your scheduling needs. And the problem is trying to be the entire marketplace on both sides is immensely, immensely hard. And a lot of companies tried it. A lot of those companies don't exist anymore. And we pivoted away to the enterprise side. And rather than trying to be our own brand, just ended up being white labeled. You know, we take 10 million bookings a month, and people never know they've booked with us, right? That's the amazing thing. So your spa salon may well use us. And we do start to work with things like Google Reserve. And that's a great tool that, you know, that allows you to be able to book by searching through Google. And then that surfaces the availability of appointment systems like ours and others that brings that closer to you. I did originally want to be the directory, and I wanted to work with other directories. So maybe I'd work with a partner directory of a specialist in nail salons or something like that. But actually, the move to the enterprise space kind of precluded that a bit. And nail salons are hard, right? You know, those kind of markets are hard. You've got a real problem with SMEs. Trying to sell software to SMEs is difficult because you've got the classic thing that you've got a quite complicated business problem. You know, their time, their staff turnover, all the rest of it is quite difficult. You've got not necessarily very technologically savvy staff at the same time. And you've got always, can I do this cheaper? Can I do this for free? Can I go back to pen and paper because that doesn't cost me any money? So trying to sell to a non-tax savvy, highly complicated problem, budget conscious market, it's not really a low-hanging fruit of technology businesses to go after.
Fantastic. I do want to throw this over to Curtis because he has some questions about customer experience.
Well, I do. And one of the questions that I've got is the terminology that you were using. There were two phrases that you're using. And being a journalist, I tend to fixate on words and phrases. So here's my first question. You talk about customer experience. You also talk about customer journey. Are these two the same thing or are they separate concepts that are somehow related?
I think the customer journey is a specific part of the overall customer experience. I mean, customer experience is a word, you know, CX is a word that's bandied around a lot to mean a lot of different things with a lot of different technologies. And we thought about this very hard, right? If you look at who's the leaders in CX, it's always ends up being Salesforce or someone again, you know, because they're like, oh, they have all these marketing tools or something like that. So CX is a very, very broad base now. What we're particularly focused on is the section within that that is about the customer journey. One of the things a lot of tools and technologies think about at the moment is either one side or the other of the customer experience. They're either looking at the online customer experience or the in-store customer experience. So, you know, you could say, you know, there's a lot of tools that track your digital experience and they'll track maybe your conversion. They'll say, look, you started on Amazon, it started on Google, you clicked on an ad for a sofa, and then maybe you bought the sofa, in which case I can credit that as a customer experience all the way through. However, if you came into the store and bought the sofa, they can't connect the two. But actually with Bookingbug, we can say, well, look, you started on that ad, you actually saw it was a $4,000 sofa, you weren't terribly sure, you booked an appointment to come into the branch to actually see one where they said they'll make sure they've got a sofa in for you. You came into the store, you spoke to the sales guy and you bought the sofa. And I can actually now track that all the way back to the Google ad at the beginning. But we're after that journey, and that online to offline journey is something that people really aren't doing terribly well at the moment. And that's where we fit really, really well, because that gap is a chasm for businesses. You know, online conversions, single digits, 3-5% if you're lucky. In-store conversions, 50%. You need to get people from there to there. And that's what we're good at. So that journey is the critical part of both making sure a customer buys, making sure they buy more, making sure they have a better experience, and then actually offering them something that a pure play digital retailer can't do. And even Amazon's getting into physical stores now. Physical stores are the future.
I love that. From photons and electrons all the way back to brick and mortar. But, you know, my next question, you talked about the experience and I really appreciate that. But as you were talking about the number of steps in that journey, you talk about all of the steps that need to be taken, all of the data that needs to be gathered. How much effort have you had to put into designing that experience, building in all of those steps, and yet not adding so much friction to the overall system that application responsiveness becomes a problem and you end up degrading the very experience that you're trying to enhance?
That's an excellent question. And I mean, obviously, we put years of experience into it, and that's why people work with us, because we're the experts. If there was a lowball question there that says, that's why you should come and talk to us. But the reality is that people do tend to overthink it. You're dead right. I the number of times I've had arguments with customers where they go, well, I don't want to have spammy customers making fake bookings, so I want to ask 57 questions first before I show them anything. And I'm like, look, that's the equivalent of Amazon asking for you your address and credit card details before they show you what they sell. which is stupid, and you wouldn't do that, right? You'd just walk away. You wouldn't even look. So you have to engage people quickly. You have to aim for the equivalent of the one-click checkout, right? If you've already got a customer login tool where they can already be an existing account holder, you don't need to re-ask their details. So we work with, you know, when we work with banks and we work with retailers. So for example, in the UK, we work with a retailer called John Lewis. You log into your existing account. Not going to ask you your name, your address. I know all that stuff, right? Or John Lewis knows all that stuff. So you just say, when do you want an appointment? Tuesday at 3 o'clock, done. Like, simple as quick as possible. But maybe it's a beauty service where actually it's complicated because you're booking the hot stone massage and the spray tan, but you can't book the spray tan after the hot stone massage or vice versa because it'll mess it up. And your business rules gets complicated, but the clever bit is to make the complexity simple and the customer engagement as quick as possible. And the interesting thing, and this is particularly relevant for banks, I talk about it as funneling and filtering. You want to funnel in as wide a number of customers as possible to get them back into your branch and back into the store. However, for the banks, they also do want to filter them to the right channel, right? They don't want everyone to come into the store. They might say, well, you know, this is a low value transaction. Maybe you can speak to a robo advisor. Maybe you can have a video conference. Maybe you can have a telephone call. How about some other channel? So they want to get your engagement. They want to get your engagement quickly, but they want to get your engagement in the most optimum channel. And that isn't actually necessarily into the store. Nowadays, it could well be. We're seeing an increasing number of video consultation based services and telephony based services and even chat services. And then obviously, you know, all the way down to sort of robo digital chat tools. So it's a real sort of smorgasbord of options to get the right engagement with the right customer.
We've been talking with Glenn Shoesmith, founder and CEO of BookingBug. Thank you so much for being here, Glenn. Unfortunately, we're running low on time, but before we close up, I wanted to give you a chance to tell us where people can go to learn about BookingBug, try it out, and see how it can fit their workflows.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, look it up on bookingbug.com. We're a global business. We've got offices in Boston and London and Sydney. So wherever you are in the world, wherever you're listening to this podcast, go and check out bookingbug.com. You can get me on Twitter at Glenn Bookingbug and come and chat to us. If you want to engage with your customers better, if you're a bank, if you're a retailer or even a government department, all kinds of people need to talk to their customers better. And this is what we do.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 nail salon bookings. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially our co-host in crime, starting with our world traveler enterprise expert, Heather Williams. Heather, where can the folks at home find you and all of your work?
Well, whether I'm at home or on the road, I am usually saying something snarky at MoBetter Wi-Fi. And if anybody's going to be in Denver in a couple of weeks, I come bearing pastrami.
Fantastic. Thanks, Heather. Of course, we want to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can the folks at home find you and all of your fabulous work?
Well, as usual, people can find my writing over at darkreading.com. I'll point to that and say various, I hope, entertaining things on Twitter at KG4GWA, on Instagram at Kurt Franklin. Got an article coming up this coming week on small business security. Hope everyone will find that interesting. And it's the heart of the conference season. I'm going to be hitting a couple more down at the Disneyplex over the next couple of weeks, but really getting ready to head to Las Vegas now in less than a month. Going to be doing Interop. So if you are interested in Interop, I hope you'll see me out there. If you want to come and you'd like a discount, hit me up on Twitter. I've got some discount codes to hand out. Happy to share those.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Curtis. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to the show to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. Go out right now to twit.tv/twiat. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, the notes of the show, co-host information, guest information, as well as the links to the show, the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll actually get those helpful download and subscribe links as well. If you want to support the show, get that audio version, video version, HD video version of your choice to get your enterprise and IT goodness each and every week. Now, after you subscribe, go ahead and share it with your coworkers, your friends, your family, whoever, because we love doing this show, and with your support, we continue to do it. Now, I have to subscribe. Also, remember, we do the show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific, live.twit.tv. And if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into our chat room live. I got it right here in front of me. We get some really great conversations stewing up in there, as well as we kind of get some really great questions for the guest in there as well. So if you're going to jump and watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room as well. Also, don't forget, you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There you'll get to see what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. Of course, you can always check out dev.office.com as well, where we post the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience and make it more productive for you. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week doing This Week in Enterprise Tech. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit. They continue to support us. Also, thank you to our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chiebert. He does all the bookings. He gets all the guests, plans the shows. Without him, we really couldn't do This Week in Enterprise Tech. And before we sign out, I have to thank our TD for today, Victor. Victor, you know the tradition, my friend. What was the today's topic of the show? You can use Alex there. Alex can help you.
Well, all I heard today was something about WebMD and toe cancer and troubleshooting for clowns. But because I learned a 10-year-old can operate the show. So, right, Jarrell?
Troubleshooting for clowns. I like that one.
So I've been training my replacement.
Close, but maybe next time there, Victor. Thank you so much. Hey, young Victor. Mini me.
Yeah, he's been operating the show today, so
fantastic. I think he did
it better. That's why it worked so well.
So much well done this time. So thanks so much, Victor. Appreciate it. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.